Joining us in this segment is Dr. Whitney Lehman, an environmental engineer, in fact, a recent PhD graduate in environmental engineering from UC Davis, returns to our show to talk about an environmental engineering matter, I guess you might say, America's Factory Farms.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here on your award-winning show.
Well, we're darn glad to have you, Dr. Lehman. Today, I thought we might want to concentrate on a subject I know that you're interested in and I'm interested in, America's corporate factory farms and what that means in terms of how we raise our meat products and how that affects the consumer. Now, this is a hard topic to know how to jump into, and I guess one approach we might want to take is to cite an article by a man named Michael Pollan, author of The Botany of Desire, wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine that was widely reprinted. It appeared locally in The Bee a few months back about what happened when he looked into the meat industry by buying an 8-month-old steer.
Mr. Pollan's article was very interesting, and it touched on a huge number of issues. It didn't touch too much on animal welfare, but more on ecological issues and the health effects and what actually happens on factory farms, at least with respect to cattle. He studied what happened to a steer that he purchased as a calf and watched it through its life. He didn't actually watch the slaughtering process, but after slaughter, what became of his steer and what profits were involved and what the cost to society were.
Well, this article personalizes the issue of what happens to the cow in a rather unnerving way. Describing how the first 6 months that this calf can be found grazing next to mom out in the fields. But by, I guess, 8 months of age, it's basically branded, castrated. And that's when things start to become, you know, the factory-esque aspects.
That's right. I think when calves are taken away from their mothers and instead of grazing on grass, they're forced to eat grain, a couple of things happen. Psychological and physical problems arise. The first being the calves are unhappy, and then they're forced to eat corn instead of grass. And there are usually physical problems associated with that, which kind of starts the whole antibiotic ball rolling. They're prone to develop infections and foam in the rumen. They're given antibiotics therapeutically at that point. And then later on, they're also given antibiotics non-therapeutically to stimulate growth. I think cattle can increase in mass by maybe 1-5% if they're given antibiotics at subtherapeutic doses.
For reasons that I think are not still 100% clear, perhaps that just the bacteria are inhibited in growing and they take less of the nutrients that are in the rumen of the cow.
That's, I think it's unclear, but I think that's what people believe, is they kill off some of the natural flora.
It does work,
yeah. Muscle mass is increased.
Well. It works, for chickens as well as cows and other animals. I think what sort of hits me between the eyes first off in this issue is, I remember being a student at UCD talking to some vegetarians, and I made the point, well, the thing about eating cattle is that cattle eat grass, and grass is not something human beings can eat. Therefore, we're using a resource that's not otherwise available to people. So ecologically, it's not so bad. And they quickly pointed out to me, no, that's not the way things are done. Cattle are raised on grain, and it takes 10 pounds of grain to make 1 pound of meat. And that is actually, you know, the grain, if it were fed directly to people, would be much more efficient use of resources. And of course, it turns out, given the way things are done in America today, they're correct.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And American taxpayers pay for corn. We really support the meat industry in two ways. First, we subsidize corn. Corn costs less to buy than it does to produce because of government subsidies. So that's one reason beef is so cheap, not in overall terms, but if you go to the supermarket and you buy beef, it's relatively cheap. We also pay for beef directly because we have to pay the USDA. Our tax money goes to support the USDA, the government agency that oversees inspection of slaughterhouses.
Well, maybe I'm naive. I guess in some ways I must be a little bit, but this sort of just, when I read this article, it just sort of hit me between the eyes that if the U.S. taxpayer is supporting the production of corn at below market value, then the taxpayer, he's basically paying to produce beef indirectly. And I suppose people who are vegetarians, that must be sort of an irritating issue if they're sort of against it philosophically, that you're being forced to pay to keep the price of beef down. Now, if corn went up to a more, if we let the market act, market forces act, and corn cost a little bit more, beef would necessarily cost a little bit more, and you'd have to pay for that. But the only people then paying for it would be the beef consumers.
Absolutely. I think the beef consumers probably should pay for not only corn subsidies, but for other ecological impacts that aren't really being taken into consideration, like runoff from feedlots, as well as paying for USDA inspection to make sure meat is safe. I assume it would be more reasonable if you bought a steak to pay a tax on top of that steak to cover all those expenses rather than just having the general public pick up the tab. But that's how government works. The general public picks up the tab for a lot of things.
Yes, it does. You know, at Davis, they used to have a cow with a hole in its stomach. It was a big attraction at picnic day. When I never did see this for, you know, several decades. When I finally asked for the cow last picnic day, they said, oh, no, it was taken away. Animal rights people felt it was unkind to the cow. But, of course, it was an educational tool because you saw a cow has these four major stomachs, and it needs that to process basically a very unnutritious substance, which is grass. But we've short-circuited all the design of the cow by putting corn through him. And this article points out that when he met this cow, it had been weaned from its mother and was now being accustomed to eating this new unnatural diet of grain. Along with the grain, as you point out, Dr. Lehman, they have to add an antibiotic. They added an antibiotic, rumenicin, that he consumes with his feed every day for the rest of his life.
Probably to treat infection at the points in which where he was weaned from grass and started eating grain, but also subtherapeutically to put on muscle mass as well.
Well, he describes every day the calf would be fed 6 pounds of corn mixed with 7 pounds of ground alfalfa hay and a quarter pound of rumensin. That's a lot of antibiotic.
No one knows how many antibiotics are used by the beef industry, but it's a huge amount. The Union of Concerned Scientists recently estimated, I think maybe 40% of antibiotic use is subtherapeutic antibiotic use given to livestock. And also the reason that corn is fed to beef, it's part of the whole factory farm production process. A steer can reach slaughter weight in 14 or 16 months fed corn and also given his antibiotic and his hormone supplement. In a natural situation where a cow was eating grass, it would take several years, 4 to 5 years, to reach slaughter weight. So it's just part of the factory farm production. Get them to slaughter weight quickly, slaughter lots of them. The profits are very low per cow slaughtered. You have to do a lot of them, and that's certainly one of the major issues.
Well, we need to get, I know out in our listening audience, we have people who are involved in the raising of cattle, and I would very much like to hear back from some of them, because I talk to people that do this, and they point out that they're really at odds with the meat industry and basically corporate America in this regard, and that this article points out that he invested in the cow, was interested in seeing what, I guess steer at this point, and was interested in seeing whether we could actually make any money. He wound up making a small amount of money, $27. But apparently in the nation, as an average, cattle producers make $3 a head over the past 20 years, which is an astoundingly low margin of profit.
Yeah, it really doesn't seem worth the effort. I think in that article, at the very end, Michael Pollan speaks to one of the cattlemen who says, well, you've got to love this job. You're not necessarily just in it for the money. I don't really understand that at all. What there could be to love about a feedlot where there are hundreds, maybe 100,000 animals all crammed together, standing in their own manure, waiting to be slaughtered.
I have to scratch my head over that one myself. But the one issue here that just hits me between the eyes, for I know we have a lot of people in the medical profession out there that, you know, somewhere within our range of our voice, doctors, nurses, health professionals, public health people. And I just don't understand. I mean, as I read about this, it's quite clear that, you know, no estimate I've seen is under 40%. And a lot of estimates are 70% of the amount of antibiotics produced in this country every year go straight into livestock. And most of it is not being done to treat diseases. Most of it's being done, like in the case of this steer, to simply enable it to grow a little bit faster. Now, what this means in terms of breeding in cattle gut or chicken guts, antibiotic-resistant bacteria that are going to come back to haunt us, is really hair-raising.
Absolutely. There's so many reports, I can't even, the one that comes to mind is the Union of Concerned Scientists article. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt at this point that I think antibiotic resistance is coming from the meat industry, not necessarily from humans.
Well, doctors, of course, are counseled to only use antibiotics when necessary. This is drilled into people in medical school. And, of course, out there in the real world, what happens? Your people come to you and mom comes with her kid and says, doctor, I need to get some antibiotics for my kid. My other doctor always gives him antibiotics. He doesn't get an infection. And you have to say, well, okay, it's clear on exam that your child appears to have a virus. And antibiotics won't do any good. Well, this is drilled into people that we have to try and resist the temptation to treat things with antibiotics for social reasons. But this is just dwarfed by the use by industry, by corporate America, in cattle.
Antibiotic use in cattle feed and chicken feed is a concern, especially with Cipro, which recently people are concerned about Cipro overuse because it's used to treat anthrax. And Cipro has been given for a long time at subtherapeutic doses to poultry and cattle, poultry especially. And the concern is that
something quite close to it, another fluoroquinolone. It's a
fluoroquinolone, yeah. That's very similar to Cipro,
yeah.
And if microorganisms become resistant to that, something like anthrax, if that becomes resistant to Cipro, then we're in trouble. So Bayer, who makes Baytril, has not voluntarily withdrawn Cipro from the market, but Abbott has drawn their fluoroquinolone, Cipro-like drug, from the veterinary medicine market.
Well, antibiotic resistance is certainly not just a theoretical concern. Back in the 1970s, two really notorious bugs became resistant to penicillin. Haemophilus influenza and Neisseria gonorrhea, the bug that produces gonorrhea in humans, because in the Philippines, where servicemen were basically interacting with prostitutes, unfortunately the Filipino population was being dosed, the sex worker population was being dosed with penicillin in high doses, which of course produced resistant bugs. This is just the nature of how things work. The studies I've seen here show that in the terms of animal feeds, when they introduced this Cipro-like drug, fluoroquinolone drug, in 1995, at that time, 1% of Campylobacter, which is the most common cause of bacterial food poisoning, was resistant to fluoroquinolones. Within 4 years, the number had jumped to 17.6%.
There's actually a lot of antimicrobial resistance is addressed in a bunch of different papers and books, but I can recommend one called Secret Agents, The Menace of Emerging Infections by Madeline Drexler. She talks about microbial resistance to a number of different antibiotics and that how that has shot up extremely high in recent years, and most people believe it's because of subtherapeutic doses of antibiotics given to cattle and poultry.
Well, I tell you, it scares the hell out of me. And, if we're going to make recommendations today, and I suppose we should if we're going to talk about the problem, in addition, the first thing we may want to do is not have corn be $2.25 a bushel, 50% cheaper than it is to grow it, and see if we let the market forces take over. Another issue might be so that we're not just relying so heavily on corn that requires antibiotics. And another issue you mentioned at the beginning, these livestock factories are polluting the air and providing great breeding grounds, stressful environments that a lot of times antibiotics have to be administered in large doses just because, you don't have this epidemics taking place in unhygienic conditions.
That's absolutely right, and that's addressed by Madeline Drexler and also Michael Pollan, I think, in his article. These factory farms, the feedlots where animals eventually go while they fatten up before slaughter, can be populated by 100,000 cattle. Chickens also confined in these tiny battery cages. There can be 100,000 of them in one large house. So the chance for disease communicability is very high. And also the living conditions are similar to those in medieval Europe. You have people in extremely crowded conditions, basically just standing in their own urine and feces, and disease spreads very rapidly.
Well, I think the people for the ethical treatment of animals certainly appear to have a point on this one, in terms of if we can use a little more expensive accommodations for the animals, you wouldn't have to do these secondary measures of then trying to treat them with antibiotic.
That's right. I think the American consumer, they want cheap and safe meat, but they don't necessarily want to pay more for it. So that's a difficult issue. Trying to raise fewer cattle on more land, the cost of meat will go up, obviously. But I think it's worth it to society in the long run to think about agricultural sustainability.
I have a Discover magazine from a few years back that cites Tufts University microbiologist Stuart Levy as pointing out that this resistance we see in bugs appears to be to some degree strengthened by reinforcements in people by what's coming in their diet from commercial foods, which is very alarming. It indicates that if you're giving all these animals antibiotics, some of it must be staying around. Because, how to explain this? If you're going to have antibiotic resistance in a bug, there's a penalty to pay. Just like if you're going to be like bullet resistance in an automobile, the armor plating is going to have a penalty. You're not going to be able to go as fast. Bugs that are resistant should have a disadvantage against bugs that are sensitive to antibiotics. But studies have shown that human beings get resistant bugs and they retain them. They're not later outgrown by bugs that are sensitive. And the supposition is that there must be low levels of antibiotic perhaps that are entering our diet that are continuing to select for resistant bugs, which is, again, very alarming.
I have read about different aspects of antimicrobial resistance, as well as even antibiotics entering the diet at levels so high that people have had allergic reactions to them who are sensitive to antibiotics. Hopefully, if antibiotics were administered correctly, that wouldn't necessarily happen. But I also did read a study where vegetarians, people who had been vegetarians for a long time, were free of antibiotic-resistant microorganisms that are found in meat eaters and also in the intestines of cattle and poultry.
Well, it makes sense that the animal's eating all that antibiotic, even if most of the antibiotic is in the gut, some of it's in the meat, and that means we're getting low doses.
Low doses in meat and milk as well. But they can be high if antibiotics are not administered correctly.
Well, Dr. Levy points out that in the French study, people that had resistant E. coli, if you then ate sterilized food, completely sterilized, that you didn't seem to get this reinforcement and that you'd then have the gut flora would return to being more normal. I guess kind of like people when your guts are torn up after eating antibiotics, we sometimes recommend that people eat yogurt and replace bad bugs with good bugs. And this may be one approach in the future, instead of feeding animals a lot of antibiotic, to give them sensitive bacteria in their guts that are more beneficial kind, and that people have already done this with some success.
That's a good point. I think sterilization of meat is an interesting issue. It comes back to people want meat and they want it cheap. And instead of correcting some of the problems at the beginning, maybe letting cattle eat grass, maybe giving them fewer antibiotics and other maybe natural substances that promote intestinal flora growth, instead of doing that, people are kind of looking at endpoint sterilization, keeping the process exactly as it is now, but irradiating meat, I think, is going to be that seems to be the next new wave of things that are happening to keep meat safe and pathogen-free, rather than trying to correct things.
Well, there's another topic worthy of discussion for a whole section.
That's
irradiated
true.
Meat, because people are very up in arms over that.
And
perhaps,
milk.
Perhaps
yes.
with not a good reason.
Yeah, I agree.
Study of 1999, 70% of shoppers, National Marketing Survey, said it was important for stores to stock antibiotic and hormone-free meat. Yet organic beef is only like 1%. But they do point out that, you know, 40% of organic food is now sold in mainstream supermarkets. And a lot of people think that as long as the people are concerned about this, the market will promote better practices.
I think the meat industry realizes that. I've read reports by the meat industry saying they understand that the consumer, even the American consumer, is very concerned about antibiotics and hormones in their meat. The European consumer is probably even more concerned with that, and Europe has not allowed hormones or antibiotics in their meat. The European Union rejects that. Americans don't seem to have as much of a problem with it.
Well, we should talk about that. We're running out of time, but we should mention that before we go from this topic, that this article talks about the fact that this steer was given a shot of hormone, and that it seems to be an irresistible urge to do it, because they give them for $1.50 of hormone added near the end of the steer's life, it adds 40 to 50 pounds of weight to a steer. Now, I was always under the impression that the cattle were given hormones to be like Arnold Schwarzenegger and build muscle mass. And I was quite startled when I learned many years ago that it doesn't do that at all. It simply retains water.
I thought it did build muscle mass as well as retain water.
It comes in so late, it's almost like the last thing you do before the cow goes to slaughter. It doesn't have time to build muscle mass. So it's just like, you know, a woman on birth control pills retaining water. It's very much the same deal. So you've watered down your beef with a shot. The penalty is your beef now contains hormones. And the Europeans, yes, I guess what, they banned it 4 years ago or...
It's been an ongoing battle, actually. But I think they banned it much longer than 4 years ago. But I think 4 years ago, a lot of arguings broke out between the United States and the European Union because they have had a moratorium and they refused to lift the moratorium on hormone-treated beef and hormone-treated milk, as well as genetically engineered foods. But I do think you were right that consumers are probably willing to pay more. They want to see, some consumers, I should say, especially in California, are interested in not just the animal welfare, but the ecological effects and health effects of hormones and antibiotics. And I think there is a market for organic meat.
But one problem we've talked about before doing this segment is that how can you know if companies like Monsanto step in with a lawsuit to prevent people from being able to label, for example, milk, you know, bovine somatotropic hormone free, saying you can't label it that way because that's implying that it's better. And there's nobody proving that our milk that's produced, you know, by injecting our cattle with hormones isn't just as good. And so how can we know?
You can't. And I think in Vermont, actually, tried to sue the government over that and lost because somebody introduced some legislation to register bovine growth hormone so that any farmers using it, they would be able to track where it went and what milk products it was in and which ones it was not in. And that was, I believe, struck down in court. So
great. Do you know anything about this recent move? They had to clarify the issues of what is organic and not organic. I think that's probably a welcome. It was being touted as a real step forward because it's so confusing to see what is this and what is that, you know, what is, because you, I have to admit, I go to health food stores and I see some of this label and I just roll my eyes because I know it doesn't mean anything.
I think the organic standards have to do with pesticide residues, certainly more than hormones or antibiotics. With at least bovine growth hormone, there are some labeling allowances. I think Ben & Jerry's was allowed to say, this product does not contain bovine growth hormone. We buy milk from farmers pledged not to use bovine growth hormone. But the federal government has made them also put on the additional label saying that there is no difference between milk coming from cows treated with bovine growth hormone versus those not treated with bovine growth hormone. But people do label their products that way, and I have seen organic milk in the store that is labeled similarly.
Well, I just can't believe this can't be challenged on a free speech issue, a First Amendment. I mean, how can you say
Ben and Jerry's did challenge this law on the First Amendment free speech, and that's why they were allowed to put on their label that there was no bovine growth hormone, but that there was no difference between milk treated with versus without. And that's really because of Monsanto. Monsanto,
which is notorious for doing that kind of aggression.
They have pushed this on the American market, and they were furious that the European Union and Canada rejected bovine growth hormone. But they have a revolving door policy, and many of their former employees go to work for the government, and it seems as though some of these key labeling issues get pushed through while their employees are working for the government, then their employees go back to work for Monsanto. So Monsanto owns our government. I believe that's why things are the way they are. We can't label genetically engineered foods or recombinant bovine growth hormone. We can't say this food contains it. You can only say this food does not contain it, but there's no difference between food that contains it and food that doesn't contain it.
Unbelievable. But at least still you can have some idea what's out there, even however convoluted the labeling may be.
It is. Most people haven't started labeling foods in that way. I wish more people would, but there are a few.
And there's another issue we got to mark on the calendar. Talk about the whole, you know, somatotropic hormone issue in milk is another. That's a worthy discussion.
It is, definitely. There's a lot of controversy surrounding the safety and use of bovine growth hormone.
All right. Well, Dr. Whitney Neiman, this has been a very interesting segment. Please come back and let's talk more about some of these same issues. God, there's so many of them.
I know. Absolutely. I'd be delighted.
You're listening to Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett, and this is KDVS 90.3 FM. Let's take a break.
Green Acres is the place to be. Farm living is the life for me. Land spreading out so far and wide. Keep Manhattan, just give me that countryside.